Okay, tonight I want to pick up in the Old Testament, and we're going to begin with the book of Daniel. We're going to be going through the book of Daniel because of a request from somebody who listens to the Bible study on the Internet, somebody from Europe that asked us if we could go through this particular book. So this is why we're kind of out of our normal sequence. We were supposed to go through the book of Numbers, I believe. Okay, listen, as far as the book of Daniel is concerned, it's one of the books I think is very, very familiar to a lot of people because of there are certain, let's say, Sunday school Bible stories in it, you know, like Daniel in the lion's den, or where the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace, and things like that. I think that the book of Daniel sticks out into a lot of people's minds. But in spite of the fact that it's a very familiar book, it's probably one of the least understood books in the Bible. Because Daniel really gets into some very, very heavy prophecies in terms of the world events, in terms of world kingdoms, in terms of the end times. And it's a book that I think a lot of people shy away with. But this book is a really fascinating book. And if you tie a lot of what Daniel prophecies bring forth with the book of Revelation, I mean, the two of them go hand in hand in a lot of respects. But also, the critics of the book of Daniel have, I think, have long tried to put down, well, the very thought that Daniel was even a prophet, because they say this book couldn't have been written at the time it did. Now, Daniel prophesied around 600-700 B.C., around that time there. As a matter of fact, he was a youth that was carried away to Babylon, and that's where he did most of his prophesying, was in Babylon as a captive. And he was in Babylon for many, many years. Daniel probably lived to be close to 100 years old, 90 or 100 years old. But his prophecies were so right on. I mean, they were dead on in terms of the prophecies, in terms of Babylon, in terms of Greece, in terms of Medo-Persia, and in terms of these other world powers, that critics say that there's no way he could have written that. They believe that this book was written after the fact. Well, to me, I just shake my head in just total disgust at these kind of people. Because, first of all, if you go back to the New Testament, Jesus himself mentioned Daniel when he talked about, and I think it was Matthew 24, when he was talking about the end times, and he was talking about the Antichrist. And he mentioned the fact when you see the abominations of desolations taking place that is spoken by Daniel the prophet, when you see this abomination taking place in the holy place, he says, then you are to flee and pray that your flight might not be on a Sabbath, or you won't be nursing, or you won't be pregnant, okay, because it's going to be a very, very difficult and terrible time. But, well, Jesus referred to Daniel, and Jesus certified him as being a prophet, that he was inspired by God to write the things that he did. And the things that he wrote, I mean, they span so many centuries, right down to even if the end of the world were to happen tonight, his prophecies even go 1,000 years into the future from tonight. So, I mean, they really are far-reaching prophecies. And, you know, when you begin to unravel this book, I mean, it is really a fascinating book. Okay, we're just going to read this chapter 1. This chapter 1 is very easy reading. I think it's very familiar to a lot of people in terms of the test that Daniel and his friends went through. But I think there's a great deal of spiritual, I think, application and insights that we can gain from this chapter 1 in the book of Daniel. It begins with verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, which is actually Babylon, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the sanctuary of his God. Then the king ordered Asbanez, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. He ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years at the end of which they were to enter into the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine with which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that might not that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youth who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this manner and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine that they were given to drink, and he kept giving them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom, and Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days, which the king had said specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. And Daniel continued in the first year of Cyrus the king. Okay, that's only 21 verses. And I read it rather than breaking it down, read the whole thing simply because it reads as a story. You need to kind of get the overview of what's taking place here. But like I said, it's kind of a familiar story to a lot of people. But if you look at, if you break it down, I think there's a lot of spiritual insight that we can gather from this. First of all, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, keep a couple of things in mind. Daniel was a contemporary of Jeremiah and also Ezekiel. All right. Now, Jeremiah, it was in Jerusalem, and he had been prophesying year after year after year, you people are going to get it from God because you have forsaken him. Sure, you worship him with your lips, but your hearts are far from him. You're engaging in all kinds of immoral, ungodly, idolatrous practices, and it was angering God. And God kept warning them through Jeremiah that if you don't change your ways, I'm going to punish you, and I'm going to punish you through King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. He's going to come down here and he's going to incarcerate you away into a foreign land. Now, God had warned them over and over again through the prophets that because of their wickedness, he was going to chastise them severely. And so, the deportation into Babylon actually took place in three different phases. The first phase, it was actually around 606 BC, and that's when Daniel went into captivity. That first phase, what happened is Nebuchadnezzar came down and he conquered Jerusalem, he conquered Judah, and he subjugated it. He didn't destroy the temple, and he didn't destroy everything, and he didn't incarcerate everybody away into prison or kill them. But what he did is he conquered them and subjugated them, and then he took with him to Babylon about 10,000 nobles. In other words, these were the cultural elite. And this was the first phase of God's punishment upon Judah to try to get his people to repent. And I think it's kind of significant that the ones that were carried away were the nobles. In other words, they were the educated. They were the ones who we would refer to on our own society as the cultural elite. And I think that's very, very significant. And I think it's poetic justice because when a nation begins to go downhill morally and spiritually and ethically and every other way, you can always look at the cultural elite who are behind it all. Look at our society today. The cultural elite that comprise in our society, of course, are the politicians, and they are the judges, and they are the lawyers, and they are the media, and they are the entertainment industry, they are in the arts. These are the ones who I think who are primarily responsible for the incredible decline, moral decline of our nation today. And they're the ones who really need to be chastised the most. But keep something in mind. They're only a reflection of the masses. In other words, these politicians don't just simply keep getting in there without the help of people who are not godly. In other words, if we had a godly nation, we wouldn't be seeing so much ungodliness in our cultural elite. We wouldn't see so much ungodliness in our leadership today. All right, I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but what I'm saying is apparently, you know, when this first deportation in 606 BC, Nebuchadnezzar took a lot of the upper class, and among them was Daniel and his three companions. Now, Daniel, obviously, and his three companions were godly youths, and I think that they were young adolescents, probably at the latest teenagers, but probably more like 12, 13, 14 years old, all right? But they were carried away along with this first group that were to be deported. Now, when they get to Babylon, look what Nebuchadnezzar does. And I have to admire Nebuchadnezzar. I think that he's one of the greatest figures in the Old Testament as far as a Gentile king is concerned. Now, he obviously did some very foolish things, very stupid things. One of the stupidest things he ever did, he landed him 7 years running around like an animal, you know, growing his hair like eagle's feathers and his nails. You know, I mean, he was running around like an animal at a judgment for one of his foolish decisions. Also, when we get further on into reading the book of Daniel, we'll find out he does another stupid, idiotic thing, and that's build this huge statue that he has everybody bow down to. But the guy, I admire the guy in terms of his leadership ability. And what we see here, I think, is very significant, because it says here, look at that verse 3 and 4, then the king, which is Nebuchadnezzar, ordered Asbenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and other nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had the ability for the serving in the king's court. And he ordered them to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now, see, to me, this is a sign of a very, very good leader. He's saying, okay, I want the choicest people. I want the brightest. I want the most intelligent. I want the most talented. I want them to become, I want them to be trained to serve in my kingdom. And I think that's very, very significant, because he sees that this is what's really needed to run a country. It's just a shame that we don't have that same mentality today. I mean, the many kings and Caesars or emperors throughout the centuries, I mean, they didn't think like that. They said, I want to surround myself with what? With clowns and buffoons and jesters and people who are going to fulfill my lust or whatever, rather than saying, I want to surround myself with really capable people. You look at Nebuchadnezzar, and you can see a man here who's interested in the welfare of his nation. And it doesn't matter to him if these people are coming from different nationality or ethnic groups. I want to know if they are capable. I want to know if they are qualified. Because if they are, I want these people running my government. That's what we need today. Instead, we have just cursed with such incompetent leadership. And it's a judgment from God. Because what? The Bible says that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And there's no fear of God in this country. We have forsaken God. This country has bent over backwards to give God the middle finger for the past 30 or 40 years. And that's why we're in the big mess that we're in today. Anyway, it says here in that verse 5, it says, and the king appointed for them daily rations from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter into king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and Daniel he assigned the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, and to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Now this is kind of significant too, because names mean an awful lot. And apparently these four youths, they had very godly names, and it was a kind of an offense to the overseer here. So he's going to change their name, because Daniel basically means God judges, or God will judge, or God judges. It was a name given by his parents. His parents had to be godly parents, and they named him for this specific purpose, that God judges. That's what Daniel means. Hananiah means who Jehovah has favored. That's what Hananiah means. And Mishael means who is what God is. In other words, who is comparable to God. That's what Mishael means. And Azariah means Jehovah helps or God assists. Now, these four Jews were given godly names. But it was an offense to the overseer, so he changed their names. From Daniel, he changed his name to Belshazzar. And Belshazzar means Baal's prince, which was one of the deities of the Babylonian kingdom. And Shadrach means inspired by the sun god. So Hananiah, whose name meant who Jehovah has favored, they changed it to inspired by the sun god. And Mishael, which means who is comparable to God, or Jehovah, means he changed it to Meshach, which means who is comparable to Shach. And Shach was one of the gods of the Babylonian kingdom, a god of Venus. And Azariah meant Jehovah helps, a god assist, and that was changed to Abednego, which means servant of the shining fire. So they've changed their names from godly names to these heathen names. But what didn't they change? What couldn't they change? They couldn't change their character. They couldn't change, you know, the type of person they really were. Now, this is kind of, I think, significant for Christians to keep something in mind. The world, a lot of times, will call us names. And remember, they called Jesus a drunkard, a glutton, demon-possessed. They called him everything in the book. And he did say to us that, hey, no student is greater than his teacher and no servant is greater than his master. Meaning that if they hate me, the world hates me, if they persecute me, if they speak ill of me, they're going to do the same thing to you. But see, here's the significant thing. They could call Jesus all the names they want as far as trying to insult him, but it didn't change his character one iota. And in a sense, the world can call us everything they want. They call us fanatical. They call us extremist. They call us dangerous. Okay, they call us bigoted. They call us hateful. I mean, the names go on and on and on, right? Mm-hmm. But does it change our character? That's the thing we've got to keep something in mind. I mean, the character is all important because that's what God looks at. And in spite of the fact that these guys were given hedonistic names, they really lived up to their godly names. And that's what we have to really strive for. And then he says here in verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine with which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servant according to what you see. Now, God obviously gave Daniel a lot of wisdom, and he shows an awful lot of wisdom in dealing with this very difficult, sensitive situation. This overseer of the king, he was given very specific instructions to teach these men, these young boys, to teach them, to instruct them, to oversee them, to make sure that they were really all the time, the money, the energy, and the effort that the king was going to invest in them, that was going to pay off. So this guy knew that his head was on the line, all right? But look at the way Daniel handles the situation. Daniel handles it with a great deal of wisdom. He approaches this overseer with a sense of humility, putting forth a special request, all right? And I think that should say a lot to Christians, because I'm telling you, I'm a little fed up with some Christians who they may have, let's say, in their particular denomination, their particular church, they may have some marginal peripheral doctrines that they make a big issue about. In other words, things like, well, a woman can't wear makeup, or she can't wear slacks, or you can't have a TV, or you can't drink alcoholic beverages. Or let's go on and on and on and on. Okay. Well, I've seen these type of people who are very, very legalistic have almost an air of superiority over them, and they kind of get in your face if you don't agree with them as far as the way they're doing things. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? But Daniel didn't have that approach. He, you know, didn't have this in-your-face approach. Well, I'm not going to do that because it's against my religious convictions, and you all can go to hell. You know, basically, you know, he had enough wisdom to approach him in a way that was very persuasive. I think it made a big impact upon the overseer. So when Daniel makes his request, he says, basically, test us for 10 days and see what happens. And if 10 days we don't measure up, then we're willing to do whatever you want us to do. That was, you know, that was very, very, I think, appropriate and a very wise way to approach the situation, that God gave him that kind of wisdom. Now, they go through 10 days. Obviously, not all the food from the king's table was unkosher. In other words, I'm sure that besides having, you know, ham and eggs and sausage and eggs and things like that from the king's table, I'm sure that they had things like lamb or veal or beef, things like that they could have eaten, okay, that would have been kosher. But Daniel made up his mind, I don't want to eat anything, whether it's kosher or not, that comes to the king's table, because there's something implied here. If you look at what a lot of times would happen in the Babylonian era, they would take the animals that they would slaughter to eat. A lot of times they would bring it before the heathen priests. They would slaughter the animal, a portion would go to their god, and they'd dedicate the rest of it to their god, and then they would get the rest. They would get the rest of the portion. So apparently, almost all the meat that went on the king's table, whether it was kosher or not, it had been sacrificed to false gods. So they didn't want to have anything to do with it, all right, because they felt like it was defiled and it would be defiling to them. Now, interesting thing, Paul dealt with this in the New Testament. If you remember when we went through the book of Corinthians, when he was dealing with the Corinthian church there, Paul was saying this, look, it doesn't matter what you eat, doesn't matter what you drink, it's not going to defile you. He said, but however, if you buy something from the marketplace, don't ask if it's been offered to idols. Remember him saying that? Don't even ask. Just buy it, bring it home. He's saying, because don't let it violate your conscience. It's fine for you to eat that meat. But he said, he warned him this, if it has been offered to idols, and you find out it's offered to idols, you better not even touch it. Even though it's perfectly permissible, he said, don't touch it, because it may cause somebody else to stumble, or it may even violate your own conscience. All right. So you see, in the same thing that was dealing with there 700 years later. Look at that verse 12. It says, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. And let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had eaten the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine that they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. Now, this test went on for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they all look fitter. They all look healthier. They all look more alert. They all, you know, they just had an appearance about them that suggested that they were the ones that had the better diet. And I think that's pretty significant that this test went on for 10 days. Now, God obviously intervened here, and he, you know, was working in that situation for them. But there's also a spiritual application for us. If you remember, when we went through the book of Revelation, when Jesus was dealing with the seven churches of Asia, he said something, I think it was very significant, to the church of, I think it was Smyrna, when he told them that he knew their tribulation, and he knew the difficulties they were going through. This particular church, they didn't have much money, they didn't have much clout, they didn't have much influence. They were just a small, struggling church. But they were a persecuted church. And Jesus doesn't have one word of condemnation against them, one word of rebuke. But he did say to them that he was going to allow them to be tested by Satan for 10 days. Do you remember that situation? Anybody remember that? No, you don't. Okay, well, let me quickly find out. I turned to there, but I couldn't.
It's in Revelation.
Yeah.
It's in chapter 2, verse 8.
Okay, verse 8. And to the angel of the church of Smyrna write, The first and the last who was dead and who has come to life says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but they are the synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Now, the 10 days in the book of Daniel, you could take it as a literal 10 days. The 10 days here in the book of Revelation, dealing with the church of Smyrna, I don't know if you could use it for 10 days literally or not. But if you don't take it literally, and because there is a suggestion there that it might be symbolic, one thing for sure, it is a definite period of time. It is a predetermined period of time. It's not going to go on indefinitely. That God is going to allow a specific period of time to pass, and you are going to be tested in this particular time. All right? The same thing that Daniel did and his friends for the 10 days. The Church of Smyrna went through for 10 days, or if it wasn't a literal 10 days, then the 10 days suggested it as a definite period of time for testing. Now, just like Daniel and his friends, when they came through that 10 days, they were far superior in terms of their intellect or their abilities or their talents or the way they looked. It says here that they were fatter, which means that they were actually looked healthier. You know, they were more muscular than the others. And I think that the suggestion here is very, very significant. Let's say, for example, look at the world we live in. The king's table, so to speak, of this world. God, Satan is God of this world. Look what he has at his table. For example, look at the TV. Look at the garbage and the never-ending flow of crud that comes out of this TV. All right? Now, I would really suggest to any Christian, actually to every Christian, but first certainly to any Christian who may be struggling in certain areas of their life and finding failure after failure after failure, I would suggest this. How about for 10 days, change your diet? Just 10 days. 10 days. Keep the boob tube off. 10 days, read God's Word. Come home, don't turn on the TV. And for 10 straight days, read and study God's Word or extra-biblical literature. Take that time that you would watch TV at the king's table and instead apply that time to sitting at Jesus' feet and listening to Him. There will be a pronounced improvement in your spiritual life. You may not see it, but there will be. Others will see it. Others will observe it. Others will know it. Just 10 days, not even 2 weeks. Get away from the king's table of this world and go to the King of Kings table for 10 days and see if it doesn't make a marked difference in your life. See what I'm saying? When you make that application, you can't go wrong. And then the same thing with the Church of Smyrna. We don't know if it was a literal 10 days. It very well could have been, but it may have been symbolic. But whatever it was a predetermined period of time. Well, this Church of Smyrna, these people, they were poverty-stricken, but Jesus said that they were rich. And when they went through their trials, they were to come out even much richer, spiritually speaking, as well as they were going to come out deepened in so many ways. This is one thing that it's just a fact of life. People who go through very difficult things in life, who are set back with, heartbreak, disappointment, or loss of a loved one, or they go through a lot of trials and a lot of tribulations. A lot of these people who suffer a great deal in this life, they end up having a depth to them that a lot of other people don't. In other words, a person who lives their life without a great deal of suffering, very often they kind of live in a gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat, and they are very shallow people. They have very little depth, very little insight, very little wisdom, very little common sense. But a lot of times if God will take us and He will, you know, for 10 days, well, for a definite period of time, put us in the darkness and fashion us and shape us and mold us in very difficult situations and circumstances, you're going to come out a deeper person, a more compassionate person, a more insightful person, a more, there's just going to be no comparison. So this is what happened with these people who were at the in the Church of Smyrna. And I think Job is another classic example. Job, by God's own definition, was a man who was upright and blameless. There was none like him in all the world. And yet when God put him through what he did, that testing period, very, very painful, very, very difficult, that poor guy went through the mental and emotional, physical agonies of the damned. And when he came through that, he was 10 times better than he was before he went in, wasn't he? Because of what he passed through. And so, you know, when God tests us for a definite period of time, it's for our own good. Just like these guys came out, and they came out superior to all those around them. Another interesting thing, just a side note. I don't know how many of these youths were in the king's classroom here. I'm assuming that there was probably, you know, a couple hundred. Maybe not that many, but there was a lot, I'm assuming. But interesting thing, we don't know anything about them today, do we? There's only four names that stick out, and all the rest are completely forgotten in history. But these four people stick out, and their names are remembered thousands of years later. Why? Because they determined that they were going to do the right thing, that they were not going to defile themselves, that they were going to be obedient to God. And I want to say something. This is what it takes for us today. We have to determine that we are not going to be defiled by the world around us. We have to determine that we are going to, you know, put Christ first, and then we're going to follow him, and we are going to obey him come hell or high water, because I guarantee you in eternity there will be the difference. For all eternity, you will see the difference. Than those people who just want to go along and get along, even in the church. It says, and in verse 17, and as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom, and Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Now, here's an interesting thing. They get together all of these youths, and they get them. Look at the criteria that they use. In that verse 4, it says, the youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning and knowledge, and who had the ability for serving the king's court. Now, this applied to all the youths, all right? Now, here's a thing you got to keep in mind. God has given every person in the world a certain amount of talent, a certain amount of abilities. Some of us have much more than others in certain areas, and so on and so forth. Okay? Of course, we're living in a society today that's so dumbed down. We want to make everybody equal. This is how asinine it is. It's like, these people are real bright here, so what we want to do is, we don't want them to excel too much because it's going to make the slower learners feel bad. So they try to put everybody together. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's so asinine. It's so ridiculous. But it's the politically correct thing to do. God's given us all certain abilities and certain talents, and we need to accentuate those talents, not to say, well, gee, you don't want to excel too much because you're going to make this person over here feel bad. No, that person over here needs to develop whatever talent God has given them. I mean, I'm telling you right now, I would love to have Lori's talent. I would love to have it. I almost covet it. To have have her talent for typing and for spelling and for getting on that computer. I mean, I would say, but God has not given me that talent. I am an ignoramus in that area. I really wish I had it. But I know that if I had it, I wouldn't consciously think this way, but I would unconsciously feel less dependent upon other people. The fact that I don't have that talent makes me aware so much more of how much I need other people, because they pick up where I can't do this. See what I'm saying? We all have certain abilities and certain talents. What we need to do is to develop them. But keep something in mind. Still, if it's just a natural ability and a natural talent, God can only use it if it's given to him, surrendered to him. If you want to use it, you can still use it, but God ain't going to use it because he don't need it in that respect. He doesn't look for people who are, oh, this person's really bright. I'm going to use this person to give my sermon. No, he's going to look for the person who is very humble and very committed to him and saying, even though this person can't speak well, he's going to be my Moses. See what I'm saying? Because he's the humble one, I'm going to use him. So he will bypass natural talent every day of the week. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, he's given us natural talent, and as Christians, we need to develop that natural talent. We really do. We really need to apply ourselves. And when we do that, you know, God gives us on top of that more insight, more wisdom, more understanding. That's just like he did with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's like they were given so much wisdom and insight. I mean, they were light years ahead of their contemporaries. But they used what God had given them. They weren't puffed up. They weren't proud. They're going to say, oh, man, I'm in the elite here. I'm in this crowd here. I'm in Harvard. I'm at Cambridge. You know, I'm, you know, baloney. No. They recognized whatever talents, whatever abilities they had, it was given to them by God. And they were totally dependent upon God in the development of their talents. And look at them. They're the only ones that are remembered today. Who knows what the other ones were? Right? I don't know how many youths there were. Maybe there were dozens. Maybe there were hundreds. Maybe there were thousands. I don't know. But all we know is there's just four of them that have left their mark. And those four were the ones who were going to use their talents for the honor and glory of God. And this, just in concluding, it says in verse 18, then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. You see, what happened here is they were tested for 10 days, and now they're 10 times better than all their contemporaries. And like I said, you look at what God did to the church of Smyrna, you look what he did to Job, even Job, who was blameless and upright, came out a ten times better man because of what he went through. And the same thing with these guys, and the same thing with ourselves. Whatever God may put us through in life, if we're willing to submit to him and follow him and obey him, we're going to come out 10 times better than we were if we just sit there and are untested. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?
Well, John, did you want to... I'm just curious, did you want to mention anything about the number 3 or the number 10? The signet shows up throughout the Bible.
You know, I think if I was to try to tie something in there, it'd be totally speculative as far as the numbers, all right? But the 10, I think is significant. Here, 10 days of testing, and then 10 days of testing for the Church of Smyrna. Wow. I think that that's a connection. Okay, as far as the 3 only suggests to me it was a very... very determined, short period of time, and it was, and the shortness of it suggests to me that the training was very intense. But the application is for us too. Our training is very intense down here for what? An eternity in serving the king.
What are the 3 phases of the Jerusalem's fail again? The first one was the...
I'm sorry, what was that?
The city and Babylon.
Oh, yeah, okay. The 3 phases of the Babylonian captivity was in 606 BC. That's when Nebuchadnezzar came down, and he took away all the nobles, transported 10,000 of them away, along with King Jehoiakim. And what he did instead is he set up a vassal king to rule there in his place. But they were subjugated. They had to pay taxes and tariffs and everything like that to Nebuchadnezzar, and that was a punishment from God. But again, the people didn't learn their lesson, and they continued to rebel, and so God says, okay, he's going to deal with them even more. So in 598 B.C., mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar came down again, and this time he overrun the city, and he incarcerated away thousands more, and he still left a vassal king to say, okay, you do what I'm telling you, you do what I say, and you can still stay here. So Zedekiah became king, and he ruled for about 11 years. But he decided he was going to rebel too. But Zedekiah, Jeremiah kept warning him, look, you got to turn from your wicked ways. You and all of these people have got to turn from their wicked ways, and they got to start obeying God. Otherwise, you're going to lose it all. Zedekiah wouldn't listen to him. Zedekiah's surrounded himself with a bunch of morons who wouldn't listen to Jeremiah, and the whole country was in rebellion against God, just like America is today. Everybody was just out there doing their own thing in terms of what they considered to be right just like it was in Judges, every man did what was right in their own eyes. Well, that's where they had gotten in Jerusalem. So in 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar brought down his armies. They took Zedekiah, who tried to escape on horseback. They ran him down, took him, they killed his sons right in front of him. That was the last thing he saw, and then they gouged his eyes out. And they dragged him to Babylon, along with everybody else, and they completely destroyed the city, tore down the temple, set it on fire, tore down the walls of the city. They just completely demolished it and incarcerated everybody away. And that was the end of it. The only people that were left there were some very, very poor, destitute people. There's very few people left. And even those people, Jeremiah said to them, look, if you stay here and be obedient to God, you can still stay in the land. But even those people rebelled, and they ended up being slain in Egypt. I don't want to get off onto that, but what I'm saying is that that was basically the three phases of their destruction. God, in his mercy, didn't do it all at once. He did it as a warning the first time, as a second warning, and a third time, it was the end of it.